May it please the court. My name is Jack Ayers from Dallas. I represent myself and my law firm in this mandamus proceeding, which concerns the propriety of an order issued by the Honorable Adolph Canales, judge of the 298th District Court of Dallas County, Texas, which disqualified me and my law firm from participating in a case in which both myself and my firm are parties. In the interest of the court's time, we believe the case is controlled very succinctly and directly by one rule of civil procedure and by one opinion that this court has decided, as well as by an ethics opinion of the state bar. The rule in question is Rule 7, which specifically, clearly, and unambiguously provides that any party to a suit may appear and prosecute or defend his rights either in person or by an attorney. It does not say any party except an attorney, and although lawyer bashing has become popular these days, as far as I know, the Supreme Court of Texas has not seen fit to change that rule. So the first problem that the trial court had was that he ignored the mandatory language of that rule. That rule has been interpreted by this court in Ex parte Schaefer to specifically give an individual an absolute right to be represented by himself, and an order requiring another person to be represented by an attorney is void.
So you read the Schaefer case as elevating Rule 7 above anything that might be in the Code of Professional Conduct, whatever we call that now, law disciplinary rules.
I would read Schaefer in connection with the ethics opinion as saying they're consonant. The exception that applies in this case, Mr. Chief Justice, is that when an attorney is a party, the disciplinary rules that have been written in regard to non-party participation by attorneys don't apply.
Are there policy reasons why those disciplinary rules should not apply in this situation? Is there something we're trying to get at in the disciplinary rules that is not applicable when the attorney is himself the party?
I think the primary problem is a constitutional one. We cite in our brief, I don't want to belabor this point because I'm sure you're aware of it, Ferretta versus California in that line of cases, which specifically and unambiguously hold that as a matter of federal constitutional right, any litigant in a state proceeding has a right to represent himself. And obviously there would be a serious equal protection problem if an attorney, by virtue of his standing as a member of the bar, was disenfranchised of his rights of citizenship to participate and represent himself. Now that does not suggest that attorneys are generally exempt from the disciplinary rule. Quite the contrary. The disciplinary rule envisions a situation in which the attorney is not a party. That distinction was drawn very well by the State Bar Ethics Commission in its opinion, number 368, which I believe we've appended to our papers. In that case, an attorney was sued in a case and desired to have a member of his law firm represent him. Under the applicable disciplinary rule, obviously, the law firm would be disqualified by virtue of the fact that the attorney who was the party would be testifying in the case. The committee held that the rule did not prohibit the participation of the attorney's firm, because the attorney was a party. Now it seems to me that those are the succinct issues in this case. I think it's instructive to focus on the language that the trial court used in this case in his order of disqualification to give you some idea of how overbroad the order was. What we were prohibited from doing was, neither I nor any member of my firm shall be permitted to participate verbally in the deposition, examination, cross-examination of witnesses, or to participate verbally in any manner, in any proceeding, in the presence of the jury, other than as witnesses in the trial of this case. It very clearly takes away our right to participate in the case as attorneys. I cannot represent myself, and I cannot have members of my firm participate in the case in any degree, in any way.
Your firm is a professional corporation?
It is, Your Honor, and the record shows that I am the sole shareholder.
Is there any case that you're aware of that applies the right to represent yourself to a corporation or entity other than an individual?
There is none that I'm aware of. We would reason by analogy, Justice Heck, to the opinion in 368 that I cited to you before. That involved a partnership. in which the man was a partner. I think the situation, ethically speaking, is analogous. I'm a sole shareholder of a professional corporation. I'm required by the state of Texas, if I elect to participate in that, to form it in a corporate form, so I have no choice. The law requires me to do that. But I think the rule is the same. Certainly there should be. There's no reason, practically speaking, to allow a person to appear on behalf of themselves and to then not allow them to represent their corporation or their firm in the same proceeding. There's no basis for that.
Do you think these cases about prohibiting corporate self-representation, like American Express versus Montfort, are just constitutionally infirm?
No, I don't think they apply when the attorney is a party. There is no case that I'm aware of, I think this is a case of first impression, where the attorney is a party. And the point I'm trying to make is it would be a enshrining form over substance to say that the attorney has a constitutional right to represent himself and then simultaneously preclude him in the face of 368 from having a member of his firm participate in the case on behalf of the corporation. I just don't see, it would be no reason. It would be a rule without a reason. And of course, the reason for that in this case is tactical. It is designed to disqualify me from participating in my own defense or my prosecution of my own case, and likewise to prohibit members of my firm from doing the same thing. And I think the other issue, as a policy matter, has to do with the presentation of the truth here. It's
You don't argue that the same ethical considerations don't apply. In other words, if you are representing yourself in a case in which you are a party and going to testify, the reasons for the disciplinary rule are matters of concern, but that your right to represent yourself should be paramount.
If you characterize it in that way, yes. The argument that I make is the disciplinary rules, and that's not my argument, it's this court's rule. The disciplinary rule gives way to the mandatory right of any party to represent himself or herself in a judicial proceeding. They're not disenfranchised of that basic right merely because they're an attorney. I wish it were otherwise, because I've been involved in one case with which the court's familiar, in which I would love to have disqualified an attorney who was representing himself, but the law didn't allow me to do that. So I'll be happy to answer any other questions that the court may have. I don't mean to be perfunctory or presumptuous, but I believe the case is that clear.
Are there any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear oral argument from respondent.
May I please the court?
May it please the court. This case, this proceeding, and this conflict between the members of the relator's law firm representing the law firm and Mr. Ayers individually did not arise as a result of opposing counsel designating as witnesses the relator, members of his firm, and Mr. Ayers individually. This is not a situation where we have affirmatively created an apparent conflict with the rules of ethics. This is not a tactical maneuver on the part of Mr. Nix or his counsel. This is instead a proceeding that arises out of, and a conflict that arises out of, the first the disciplinary rules and now the disciplinary rules of professional conduct, with the relators designating Mr. Murcho and Mr. Ayers both as fact witnesses and as expert witnesses, and designating Mr. Murcho as counsel of record for both of the relators. When this conflict was brought to the attention of the relators, to digress for just a moment, the relators represented to Judge Canales in two pleadings that they filed, their motion for continuance and their motion for pretrial conference. They acknowledged that they were in violation of their ethical duties by having designated themselves as expert and fact witnesses and also as counsel of record, and they asked for a delay. If Judge Canales would simply delay the disqualification, they would step aside contingent on the ruling on their motion for summary judgment. The delay was effected. The motion for summary judgment, however, was overruled as of October of 1989, and Mr. Murcho has continued to serve as counsel of record for both of the relators in this case. Further on this matter of issue definition, is with respect to what this mandamus proceeding is about, I believe, the arguments and the cases concerning the rights of self-representation were not presented to Judge Canales by the relators in their brief, which is attached to the petition for writ of mandamus. Mr. Ayers representing himself individually and the right of self-representation and whatever constitutional right affords that was not the issue that Judge Canales was grappling with in the district court. Instead, the problem Judge Canales was dealing with were associate members of the firm of Jack Ayers, a professional corporation, representing both of the relators. This involved the case first being filed by Christopher Payne of the firm of Jack Ayers PC, who gave way to Mr. Murtaugh, who gave way to Mr. Laird, who gave way to Mr. Taggart, who subsequently gave way to Mr. Murtaugh again. And Mr. Murtaugh was designated on the court's docket sheet as the counsel of record for both the law firm and for Mr. Ayers individually.
Is it your position that if a law firm is a party to a case, it has to get outside counsel?
That is our position. I think that is the requirement of the disciplinary rules and the policy.
What would be the reason for that policy?
I think there are several public policy reasons behind the disciplinary rules that would cause a law firm as a party to use outside counsel. Some of these matters are dealt with in the ethical considerations under the old Code of Professional Disciplinary Rules of Professional Conduct. They're also dealt with in the Supreme Beef Processors case. I think they number several. Some of those are simply when an attorney is representing his law firm, he necessarily places himself in the unseemly position of having to argue his own credibility and the credibility of other members of his law firm. In a jury trial, that's an appearance that I think we're trying to avoid in the disciplinary rules. It also creates a problem with the relationship between counsel in a case. If counsel in a lawsuit, as this court well knows, are to comport themselves and deal with each other in a very professional manner, and there are certain rules, the disciplinary rules and other rules of professional conduct that guide, that control that relationship, those rules are tested strenuously when opposing counsel is also a fact witness and has to be cross-examined. And opposing counsel is also an expert witness and needs to be cross-examined. It also tests the relationship between counsel, who also is a witness, and the court, because the court must deal sometimes in front of a jury with a witness and chastise that witness for not answering questions, for not conducting himself properly. And that's a different relationship than Judge Canales would have with a lawyer who simply is a lawyer in the case.
What reason have you given that wouldn't be applicable to a lawyer representing himself pro se without any other witnesses? You gave me about
I have not given you any reasons that would differentiate a lawyer representing his law firm and a lawyer representing himself.
So a lawyer can't represent himself in a case in which he's a party.
That is our position, that if Mr. Ayers truly wants to represent himself in this action, and I can't speak for Judge Canales or his order, which the relators drafted and submitted to Judge Canales, but with respect to my firm and my interests and Mr. Nix's interests as a real party in interest, I do not see, especially with the promulgation of 3.08 of the Disciplinary Rules of Professional Conduct, any ethical problem with Mr. Ayers representing himself in an individual capacity. It may be unwise for him to do so, but it is not, in my opinion, unethical. However, Mr. Ayers, should he choose to at some point in the future seek to represent his law firm, a professional corporation, a separate entity, I do believe you have a conflict with the disciplinary rules, and the public policy purposes behind that disciplinary rule act to prohibit that representation.
How is the jury going to make this demarcation, Mr. Ayers representing himself, which you're saying he can do, but yet he cannot represent his corporation, and he's a sole shareholder? How does a jury or a trier of fact to make that distinction?
I think in any case where you have multiple parties, it becomes apparent to a jury that separate counsel are representing separate parties. I mean, the professional corporation and Mr. Ayers are separate entities. And if necessary, if there's any confusion there, the judge could give an instruction to the jury that these two entities have separate counsel. But there is also the possibility, in any case, that the causes of action against the professional corporation or against Mr. Ayers individually could be non-suited, they could be severed.
I'm talking about the practicality. I mean, if we have a trial and you're asking the trial court to instruct the jury that anything that Mr. Ayers said applies to himself only but not to the corporation because he cannot represent the corporation, or anything that Mr. Ayers said or testified to can be taken by you only as his own defense but not the defense of his corporation. Is that type of instruction you envision?
Well, Justice Gonzalez, I would think that the purposes behind the disciplinary rule would be paramount over whatever practical problems there might be in the district court in affecting representation of two separate entities by two separate counsel.
Well, why don't the disciplinary rules prohibit an attorney from representing his own self in a case in which he's a partner?
I think that, in my opinion, the promulgation of 3.08 added to 5-101 and said that it was not intended to interfere with the self-representation or the representation of a lawyer pro se. I think the reason for that is an acknowledgement of this constitutional right of self-representation in Rule 7. But that disciplinary rule, I do not think, allows a law firm to be represented by members of that law firm for all of the reasons that the disciplinary rules exist. It would be an extremely self-serving interpretation of the disciplinary rules for the bar to allow lawyers to represent themselves for economic reasons or for convenience, and yet if you have a client, that client cannot utilize a lawyer as a witness. And I don't think that the disciplinary rules should be interpreted in that way to protect the bar from having to hire outside counsel and to do that which a layperson would necessarily need to do under the same circumstances. With respect to Ethical Opinion 368, we do not believe that it is dispositive of the issues before this court simply because the in-house corporate counsel and the attorney who was representing the corporation in that case, who signed off on the pleading and had designated themselves as witnesses in the case, were not themselves party to the suit. And neither was the attorney's law firm a party to that suit.
That'd be all the more reason to keep them from testifying, wouldn't it? The fact that they weren't parties. Whereas you want to keep now a party from testifying and acting on his own behalf.
I think under the difference between the Ethical Opinion 368 in this case is that under Opinion 368, the attorney who was actually doing the representation was not himself going to take the witness stand, was not placing his own credibility in question. And that's very different from this case, where Mr. Murto, in representing Mr. Ayers and Mr. Ayers' professional corporation, will testify as a fact witness, will testify as an expert witness, and will also be serving in the third capacity as counsel. And that's where the public policies behind the disciplinary rules comes into collision.
Has he been deposed? Has Mr. Ayers been deposed?
Both Mr. Ayers and Mr. Murto were deposed in their fact witness and their expert witness capacity. And testimony was elicited that can now be used by Mr. Nix on direct or as cross-examination testimony. The
principal issue in this case is whether there was a custom and practice between Mr. Nix and Mr. Ayers that would cause a fee to be paid in this case.
That's one issue of the case, but more importantly, there was an oral agreement between Mr. Nix, alleged by Mr. Nix. The same oral agreement that had existed between these parties for 10 years had involved six other referral fee cases in which the cases were handled by Mr. Ayers' firm, forwarded to him by Mr. Nix. Referral fees or forwarding fees were paid in each of those cases. They were all of a much smaller amount than this case.
Is there alleged to be an oral agreement pertaining specifically to this case?
Yes.
What is the status today? Does Mr. Murto represent both Mr. Ayers individually and the PC?
We have attached to our amended answer and filed a motion for leave with this court for the court to accept the amended answer, the court's docket sheet, which clearly shows Mr. Murto as counsel of record for both of the relay tours. With respect to the existence of this oral agreement, Justice Hacken, the reason this case, more than any other, requires the enforcement of the disciplinary rules. We're dealing with an oral agreement. We're dealing with a case involving two attorneys. One will testify that there was no agreement, or the agreement had specific terms that did not evoke a referral fee. Mr. Nix will testify that they had an oral agreement, one that elicited or justified his claim for a referral fee. The credibility of the witnesses is going to be very important in this case. The jury will ultimately need to decide which of these two lawyers is telling the truth and which lawyer is wrong and not to be believed, and that party will lose. But Judge Canales was trying to affect here.
Isn't that true in every case where we have a sparring match between two parties? Credibility of the issue?
Not in every case, Justice Canales, and not in to this degree where you're dealing with an oral agreement. I think, for example, in medical malpractice cases where you're dealing with medical records and medical science, the credibility of the witnesses.
I'm talking about swearing match, where you have an oral agreement between laymen. The jury or the trier of fact has to make those determinations. Credibility.
That's true.
So why is it any different here?
The swearing match and the test of credibility is not different in this case than in any other case that you have that, but the need for the disciplinary rules to protect the bar and the integrity of Justice Canales' court and to protect the integrity of the judicial process is heightened when you have a case where credibility is such an important issue in the case. And what Justice Canales was trying to achieve here was simply to protect the image of the professional bar, the integrity of his court, and the integrity of our judicial process, so that whichever of these parties lose this litigation, our profession and our court system is not also necessarily a loser in that process in the eyes of the jury that witnesses this fight.
In your explanation of the purpose, you didn't list disadvantage to the defendant. Do you claim that Mr. Nix is disadvantaged by the relators representing themselves in the case?
We have not alleged that. I do not perceive that. I think that cuts both ways. If Mr. Ayers represents himself, there are advantages and disadvantages to the defendant. It simply makes for a very awkward ethical situation for me to deal with at trial. But to answer your question, no, we've not alleged that specifically, and I don't think that the disciplinary rules, as I read them, require that there be some disadvantage for the opposing party. This is a matter of ethics and safeguarding the profession. My time is up, and if there are no further questions.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Ayers, you've heard the saying that any lawyer who represents himself is willing to take your chances.
Yes, sir. I believe so. I would really like to have Mr. Nix in the courtroom and have an opportunity to cross-examine him. I've tried not to go into the merits of his claim. He's entitled to make it, and I'm entitled to defend it. And I'd like to do that. I think I'm entitled to do that. And I guess we'll see what the jury says about who's telling the truth. I'd like to correct three things that Mr. Key said. I hope they were misstatements unintentionally. First one was that alleged that we acknowledged that we were in violation of the ethical rules. I was in violation of them by representing myself, and we acknowledged that we were going to disqualify ourselves and get other counsel. There's no such statement in any paper, and that's simply not true. What we did say was we intended to hire other counsel, and we have. Mr. Kelso, my former partner, is my co-counsel in the case, and if his health permits, he intends to participate in the trial. But we never at any time said anything like that, and I hope Mr. Keith just overspoke when he said to the contrary. Next thing Mr. Keith suggested to the court was that we did not argue or did not present to Judge Canales our right to self-representation. That also is not true. It was directly argued to Judge Canales that we had the right to represent ourselves, and Judge Canales clearly and unequivocally disqualified me from representing myself. The Judge Canales was just wrong. It is as simple as that. And there's nothing that Mr. Keith can say to resurrect it, wrapping himself in the Republic's flag, not to the contrary withstanding. Another statement that Mr. Keith made, which I'm not sure that I understood at all, was that we had drafted the order for Judge Canales and the language in it was our choice. That also is not true. Mr. Keith drafted the order. We suggested the change granted in part and denied in part, which was included. We did not draft the order. Now Mr. Keith concedes that the order under review before this court is in fact erroneous and justifies mandamus because Ayers, according to Keith's own admission, can represent himself, both under the old rules and the new rule, which specifically allows it 3.08. Now we're only arguing about whether or not Ayers or a member of his firm can represent the corporation as well. Again, we point to Opinion 368. Opinion 368 says a partner who has a financial interest in the case can represent another partner in which the partnership has a financial interest in litigation in which that partner is a party. What is the difference? What is the practical difference in those situations? I don't see one. I would point out to the court, Mr. Keith wants to suggest to the court that this is a question of the status of a party as a witness, and in fact, the trial court's order draws no such distinction. We are disqualified in this case, whether or not we will be witnesses. In other words, to take a hypothetical example, if Joe Jamail and I should form a partnership tomorrow and I should desire to have Joe represent me in this case, he would be disqualified. He knows nothing about the case, would not be a fact witness, would not be an expert witness, but under the order before you, he would be disqualified. No member of my firm can participate in the case in my defense, period.
And that is... That issue rises to constitutional levels as well, your right to represent your...
I don't know. I think it, and we run it on the computer, and I'm sure you'll do the same thing, but we cannot find a case comparable. The closest thing we find is Ethics Opinion 368 by the Texas Bar, dealing with a partner. And as Justice Gonzalez correctly observed, the distinction there is really illusory. A partner has the same financial interest, if you want to call it that, in the success of a partner's claim as a party in a lawsuit that a sole stockholder has in his corporation. Maybe a sole stockholder has more. Consider the mischief, if you would, that would be involved in a situation like that. As a practical matter, how can a trial court say that a person can represent themselves but can't represent the corporation that controls their life's blood and their life's work? It's an illusory distinction. Really, what the argument is...
We do make that as insofar as the self-representing person is a non-lawyer.
In a corporate context.
Yes.
In a corporate context, that's right.
One of your paralegals is being sued, they could represent themselves, but could not...
Couldn't represent the corporation. That's right. What I'm saying is that this is a distinction that we've drawn for attorneys. The reason for the rule nobody's mentioned has to do with lawyers representing other people. Primarily, the Code of Professional Responsibility is designed to protect the public and to require lawyers to observe minimum standards of conduct to protect the public. I don't need anybody's protection. I can protect myself if I just be let alone by the trial court. All I want to do is represent myself and represent my corporation and take Mr. Nix on toe-to-toe. That's all I ask. I'd like to do it with both hands, not one. That's all I ask.
But the argument is, by you doing so, is you're damaging the image of the bar.
I don't understand that. I didn't ask Mr. Nix to make this unfounded claim.
But he said he had paid him, he wouldn't be here.
Yes, well, Mr. Nix says a lot of things, Your Honor. But Mr. Nix is entitled to say those, at least in a judicial proceeding. But that doesn't change the facts. All I'm saying is I don't think it disenfranchises the bar. It's not my fault the man makes the claim against me. And it's not my fault that I have to defend myself. As a matter of fact, this case has now been realigned where I'm the defendant in the lawsuit. I don't know if that's before you. We can supplement to show you that if it makes any difference. I don't think it does. As a party, I've got a right to represent myself.
Any other questions?
Excuse me.
Thank you. That concludes the argument in the first call. The court will now take a brief recess.
The audience will be in recess.